We don't know what the physical difference is, so we don't spend any time on that. But a couple of the aspects of the physical part of the disease are most necessary for me to remember, keep uppermost in my consciousness all the time. Number one, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. There isn't a case in medical history where anybody like me ever returns successful drinking. I must keep that forever in the uppermost regions of my consciousness. Secondly, the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total abstinence. Now, this is tough for us to see. So tough. Because when we get a little distance between us and the jug, the old subconscious starts telling us you're building up some good drinking time. You're getting strong. You know, you're building up some good drinking time. There's no such thing as an alky building up good drinking time. I'm actually 26 years worse off so far as successful drinking liquor is concerned than I was when I got here. And I know it. And I don't have to take a drink to prove it. That's one of the greatest arguments for staying close to and being active in Alcoholics Anonymous that there is. Because all you got to do is to be in these meetings to keep your eyes open. Because your friends are forever taking that drink for you. You know. And if you watch them, you won't have to take it. You'll have to watch a bunch of them die, and you're not going to like that at all. Because many of them, you would rather die yourself. It's a bad old lesson, but it's very effective. I've never caught myself once in 26 years toying with the idea that I might handle a little light wine and beer. Not one time. Because I know better. I know that the physical part of the disease gets worse with the passage of time, even during long extended periods of total absence. And lastly, the physical part of the disease is incurable. Some mutt out there at our place was standing up here talking to our group the other night, and he says, you know something? He says, if Howard Hughes was an alcoholic, he'd have to come to us for help. Isn't that something? Now, inasmuch as there's nothing we can do about the physical but accept it, we do that. And then turn to the other half of the disease. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. The obsessions of the mind that cause us to drink. When the body's dry, there is no physical demand for liquor. The first drink is mental. The second drink and the 542nd drink is physical. But the first one is mental. And if you and I want to get rid of the bottle, we have to be rid of its cause, the obsessions of the mind. And that's what our program is all about. Now, the American Medical Association has said in recent months, alcoholism is a disease, it has symptoms, it is treatable but not curable. And the only way an alcoholic can successfully live is not to take that next drink. But they cannot tell us how not to take the next drink. They can't tell us. They can tell us not to take it, but they can't tell us how not to take it. But our program does. It gives us a formula that is absolutely foolproof. And all you and I must do is to fulfill the conditions of the formula. And something happens, and we don't have to drink it. Something happens, and we don't have to drink it. I told you, I was periodic for the last 10 years. I was physically as sober as I am tonight, between every two drunks. But I always drank again. Even looking at a record with physically sober eyes. I still got drunk again. When it came my time to drink, I got drunk. For 10 years. And I'd built up quite a record by that time. And it was all bad. I never had one good drunk in the last 10 years. But I kept trying. The obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. Now that's the reason I believe our book, when it says lack of power was our dilemma. And if we lacked the power, we had to find one. And it must be a power greater than we are. Obviously, says the book. Obviously. Now, believe it. The book says under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems that there's only one defense against that first slug. And that is help from a power greater than ourselves. And I believe it just as much as I believe I'm standing right here. And for just as simple a reason. If I could have remained sober, I wouldn't believe it. I could not remain sober, therefore I believe it. Because something happened 26 years ago, and I haven't had to have a drink or pill since. And I didn't do it. So I believe that it's necessary that we have help from power greater than ourselves. But in the same breath, I say that I think one of the biggest hurdles we have as individual members of Alcoholics Anonymous is in our attempt to get that help from the power greater himself. Now, isn't that a terrible thing to say? But I believe it as much as I believe I'm here. Because, you see, I did not come to this program to find God. I did not come to this program to get my wife back. I did not come to this program to get the love of my kids back. I did not come to this program to get my job back or my health back. All of these things were gone and should be gone, and I knew it, and I wasn't even entitled to have them back, and I knew that. I came here hoping against hope that I might find a way to live that didn't include that first slug, to get rid of that flip. I had it. And drunks just like you, who were not drunk, said to me, if you want these things, do these things. Here's the things we did, now do them. Do them to the best of your ability, one day at a time. And see what happens. And I didn't have any more sense than to do them. And I still haven't got any more sense than to do them. I'm still doing them. And I haven't had to have a drink or a pill. Now, a lot of other things have happened, too, that I wasn't working for. You know? So, my big hope is that we might quit hunting for God and do these things for sobriety. Because when we fulfill the conditions, we eventually wake up to the fact that the conditions for sobriety and the conditions for the good life and the conditions of God are all the same. They're all the same. And by doing them, things happen. And by not doing them, nothing happens. How many times have you heard, I tried Alcoholics Anonymous, it didn't work for me? You know? Of course it didn't, and it never will. Alcoholics Anonymous is a formula. Formulas don't do anything. Recipes don't bake cakes. It's a way to bake a cake. This is the best formula that has ever been conceived in the mind of man through the grace of God for an alcoholic to obtain and maintain sobriety. If he does it for sobriety. But if he gets down to step three and says, uh-oh, no, wait a minute. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God and we understood him. Don't understand him. I got to get me another book. I gotta get me a tutor. And they toot all over the place and still toot. The best way in the world to stay drunk is start interpreting the steps. You interpret and nip, and nip and interpret, and interpret and nip. And then you nip and don't interpret. Don't say, here are the steps we interpreted. Here are the steps we took. Of course, this, again, is what's wrong with this program. You and I know we're drunks. That line couldn't mean nothing. There's only one five-letter word in it. Here's the step we took. Well, a drunk can read that and just pass it up. We like big words. If there were a couple of psychedelics in there. Traumas? Oh, we've had a few traumas in there, you know. We stop and look at it, because those are big words. I don't know what they mean, but they're big words. But no, it says here are the steps we took, so it don't mean nothing but life. That's all it means. Here are the steps we took. Now, when you and I get simple enough to took them, we're home free. And until we took them, nothing happened. Now, I want to leave that laying. Play a little while. You know, a lot of things happen to you as you go along in this society. Lately, we're getting lots and lots of youngsters in our program at home. Many, many youngsters. And I mean young. I sat in a meeting the other night with a kid 11 years old that had 40 days of sobriety. 11 years old. 40 days of sobriety. A confirmed alcoholic. Now, a lot of these kids tell me, how in the hell do you know how I feel? You know? You haven't had a drink for 26 years. You're too far away from it. You don't know how I feel. Well, I guess I know how I feel. Because, you see, I haven't quit working with wet drunks. There is no way that you can get any older than your last session with a wet drunk. That's as old as you are in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I'll never quit. Everything goes before you when you're working with a wet drunk. You know, every feeling that he has, every pain that he has, and every thought that's going through his mind. And it's just as fresh as yesterday, you know? People say to me, when do you think is a good time to take the fourth step? And I say, you done asked the wrong man. You asked the wrong man. Because I think the best time in the world to take the fourth step is when you've taken the first, second, and third. Right then is a beautiful time to take four. You can't take four until you've taken one, two, and three. Because you're not that honest, you know. And then the fifth step. I get in bad every time I come down here. Because there's a lot of people in this part of the country that think you got to run every third Tuesday and take an inventory, fifth step. Fifth step all over again, you know. 2 years ago, I was riding someplace with somebody down here, and they told me they'd taken 26 fifth steps since January, and this was November. I said, what the hell are you trying to do? Kill yourself? I'm thoroughly convinced that anybody that takes the fifth step twice is bragging. A lot of people want to shoot me for that. Because they say, wait a minute, I wasn't honest enough to put it all down the first time. Of course you weren't. And you're not enough honest enough now to put it all down. And you're never going to be honest enough to put it all down. Because you can't think of it in one sentence. But again, if you're working with wet drunks, you're taking a continuous fifth step. And you don't even have to think about it. Because every session you're in, something new comes out. And you share it with the guy you're working with. And you're taking an everlasting fifth step. And you're not even thinking about you know. Now, I've been talking a great deal with the guy this weekend that thinks he has a hell of a problem in front of him. And he does if he keeps trying to do it. He does if he keeps trying to do it. If I'd have had to work out my defects of character one at a time, I'd have died 26 years ago. If I could work out my defects of character in the first place, I wouldn't come here. I wouldn't need you. I wouldn't even need God if I could have worked out my life. I'm hired down someplace. I had to be hauled out. I had to be towed for a while. Now, I don't read my book that I have to go and beat my brains out over my defects of character. My book says we've made a searching and fearless moral inventory, writing it down. We write it down. We share it. And they give us a good push with a pitchfork. Because they say you got to share it with God and yourself and another human being. That's another bad thing they put in there. Well, I can get under the table here and share it with myself and God. But if I have to lay that dirty linen out before another human being, you know, that's a king-size ego buster. You got much ego left after that when you ain't done it. So you write it, you share it. You become willing to give it away and you give it away. You become willing to give it away and you give it away. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Now, that's the easy way to do it. The hard way is to beat yourself to death. I got a lot of work to do. I worked on my alcoholic problem for 10 years. The last 5 years, 90% of my waking time was spent on the problem. And the harder I worked, the worse it got. The more I looked at it, the bigger it grew. It was just like fertilizing, watering, and cultivating a weed. It grew out of all proportions. And it never quit growing until I quit looking at it. And started looking at and trying to live in this answer. And the problem disappeared, and I didn't even know when it left. The help is here when we do the thing for sobriety. So, let's not try to do this thing all by ourselves. Let's share it with our partner in the business of living. People say to me, great big tough men say to me, Chuck, when did you get rid of your fears? When did you get rid of your fears? And they're big, tough guys. And you know, it's tough. Because I can't tell them. Because my fears died with me. My fears died with me 26 years ago. And I can't say, well, I'm different. You know? But I am. Not because I shook different. Or drank different, you know? Or sounded different when I was working out of set of dry heaves? I don't believe the neighbors have known whether it was me or you. But I couldn't get here until the bottle had killed me. And I got here with no expectancy at all. No expectancy at all. I didn't expect nothing from nobody, no time. And I had 3.5 years of the most beautiful freedom that anybody ever heard tell of. A period of the greatest sequence of miracles that I ever lived through. Because every little piece of the jigsaw puzzle of life fell together in those 3.5 years. But something bad happened, too. Something bad happened. In that 3.5 years, I became somebody again.
Yeah.
That rights. And when you got rights, you got to defend them. And you're in trouble all over again. Now, our book tells us that the greatest obstacle you and I have is alcoholics. It's resentments. Resentments kill more people than anybody. Okay, says the book. But resentments don't come first. Rights come first. And so I had to start surrendering all over again, consciously, after 3.5 years. And this offered one of the great problems in my life. I couldn't understand how this damned ego came back after I'd been without it for 3.5 years, you know? And I looked at that for 12 years, and I could not find any reason for that ego to come back. And I had some pretty rough times. My 11th year was the worst year I ever lived, drunk or sober, because I had to lose and win in my 11th year when I was right, dead right. But I still had to lose and win. And if you think it's tough to lose and win when you're wrong, try it when you're right. Like it beat me to death. And I kept looking at this thing. Why does this have to happen? When I'd been totally free. And I was already 16 and a half years in this program. Before I came to see something good in the human ego. And I got an answer that's just as comfortable with me as an old pair of shoes. This is the burr under the saddle. This is the thing that keeps you and I walking. And after we've made a commitment, we have to keep walking. Life will not let us stop. We have to keep walking. So, this is the thing that keeps us walking. We get uncomfortable. And we, after a while, we get very sensitive to being uncomfortable. And we start having to look and find what we have allowed to get important enough to get between us and our program and our God. And we have to eliminate it. Through an additional surrender. The time will never come, in my way of thinking, when it won't be necessary for you and I to surrender. Continuously surrender. And we have to keep walking. Now, my last 10 years, along with my good wife, she's a non-alcoholic. She does lots of work with the Al-Anon. The last 10 years, the biggest part of our time has been spent with men and women from 10 to 25 years sober who are exploding right in the middle of their skin. In my area, the man that's the oldest in the program, he's 32 years in the program, and I sat with him the other day on the bed. He says, Chuck, I've given up. He says, there's nothing to live for anymore. And he's 32 years in this program. God, this just kills me. This just kills me, you know. Because all we got to do is to surrender out of these things. Make them opportunities instead of crises. We surrender. We make that next surrender. And turn the crisis into an opportunity. And this has been, Mr. C, in my greatest activity in the last several years. You see, it don't make a damn bit of difference what happens to you or to me. It don't make a damn bit of difference what happens to you or to me. It's our reaction to what happens that kills us. If we don't react, nothing's happened. Nothing. And so it's necessary that we keep doing these things forever. For instance, I wish I had all day What time is it? It's time I was quitting. I'd like to talk about this all day long. You see, one of these days we have to come to see that people don't act like they act because they want to at all. But because they have to. Now, every alcoholic in this room will quickly admit that he drank against his own will. That the obsessions of the mind are greater than the willpower. So we take unto ourselves the privilege of hiding behind obsessions of the mind. But we won't give them to the alcoholic, the non-alcoholic world. They haven't got any right to have obsessions of the mind. They're not alcoholics. This is part of our disease. You know? But they have obsessions of the mind just as we do. You know, the man never lived that hates me bad enough to want to tear me down. Never lived. There's nobody that thinks that much about you. One of the greatest things that ever came out in the grapevine was people wouldn't be so concerned about what other people think about them if they knew how seldom they did. Now, let me tell you what I'm talking about. 30 years ago, my wife says to me, "Chuck, why can't you drink like Ted?" Now, she only said that to me. Because she immediately gave me a project. It was absolutely necessary from that second forward for me to get old Ted falling down drunk in front of my wife. Now, I didn't dislike Ted. I loved him. He was not only one of my greatest friends, but he was my benefactor. His company fed me for 20 years. 40 years, actually. They were my best customers. We drunk together, gambled together, played, sang, and danced. And Ted was one of the best drinkers I ever saw. And still is. When he was loaded, he was perfect. He stood exactly correctly. He spoke precisely and with perfect English just before he'd fall on his face. But see, Ted wasn't an alcoholic. And I didn't want to get him drunk because I hated him. I loved him. I always did. But hell, I couldn't let my wife think, "Why can't you drink like Ted?" So I had to get him drunk. Now, just to give you a little parallel to that. A few years ago, I went from Laguna Beach to the Ohio Street Group. Some of you have heard of Clancy. That's his hangout up there. And I went up there, and it was on a Saturday. And I'd been drinking coffee all day, and I got up there, and of course my first stop was the little boy's room. And there was a guy in the little boy's room, and he took a look at me, and he says, "Uh-oh." He says, "Are you speaking here tonight?" And I says, "Think I am." Well, he said, "I wish I'd known it, I'd have gone to Malibu." I says, "You still got time, and I got the money." I says, "You go out there in the hall and call a cab, and I'll pay your cab fare to Malibu and back. And there's going to be a good meeting up there. They always have a good meeting on Saturday night. So you run along up there, and I'll pay the cab fare." Oh, he says, "I was just kidding." And he started to leave, but he couldn't make it. He came back, and he says, "Chuck, you know how you ruin every talk you ever make for me?" And I said, "No, I'd be interested." He says, "You take your coat off." I says, "Another good reason for you to go to Malibu." I says, "This is a pretty warm night, and I'm just liable to chuck out of this jacket any time. So you run on up there." Oh, he says, "Don't kid me." He says, "You don't take your coat off because you're hot. You take it off for the effect. I know, because I'm a public speaker, too. Now, not too long ago, he couldn't have gotten out of there with a tooth in his head. Every one of them had been in his stomach because I'd have knocked him down there. But this time, what happened? I didn't have a project. My inside says the boy's hurting. The boy's hurting. I hope something comes out that'll give him a clue, you know? Now, this is the difference. People don't act like they act because they want to, but because they have to. And when we come to see this, they can't hurt us. There's no way they can hurt us. Because we know that all of God's kids are doing the best they can according to their light. That is, according to their understanding. When we know better, we do better. Now, a lot of people will say to me, "Oh, that's not true. I always knew better than to drink whiskey." No, you didn't. If you'd have known better, you wouldn't have drunk it. You know better now and you don't drink it, you see. I hated whiskey when I was a kid because I knew what it did. We were awful poor. And I worked from the time I was born. And I finally got enough money to send Sears Roebuck and give me a trench coat. You remember those trench coats? And God, I was proud of that trench coat. This was the greatest thing I'd, you know, you never had store-bought clothes. I had a 3.5-year-old brother, a brother that was 3.5 years older than I was, and I got his clothes. I never had any clothes of my own until I could buy them. And I got this beautiful trench coat, and I'm so proud. And one day my dad borrowed it without my permission. And he went to a labor meeting. And it came a bad storm. And we lived quite a little ways from the railroad. And he was coming home and he got down 2 or 3 times in my trench coat and ruined it. You know? God, he'd like to kill me. All the dough I'd saved, I'd put in that coat. And my dad had ruined it. Because he was drunk. You know? So I hated liquor. Just as I hated many other things in life. And I want to tell you this morning that I'd be afraid to hate the devil now. Because everything I ever hated in life, I've had to do. Now think about that. Everything I ever hated in other people in life, I've had to do myself. So we learn that that's not the right motive. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. And that's why it works. Now I'm going to close up shop. Again, I don't like to because I never feel like I've said anything. I don't think I've said anything yet that is worth coming down here for. I'd like to talk a long time, but you got to go home. Now, I believe with everything in me that we, the people right here in this room, and people like us all over the world, are the most fortunate segment of God's children who live on this earth. We are the most fortunate. There's nobody as fortunate as we are. Why? Because we have a terminal illness. And because our illness is progressive. And because the time comes when it's no longer possible for us to survive without an answer. And at long last, we come here. Hoping for one thing, that we might live till we die. Without having to drink. Because we want to spend that time rubbing out the record we've already written on the blackboard of life. And people, drunks who are not drunks, they hear the things we did, and we do them for sobriety. And we start making discoveries. Now, you can't discover before the fact. You discover after the fact. It has to happen before you can discover that it's happened. You see? So in 6 months, I discovered that I'm sober, and have been all the time. From the minute I said to myself, from the second I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I'll find Alcoholics Anonymous. Until right now, I've never had a drink or a pill. So, I discovered that after 6 months. And that was the first in the series of discoveries. The second one might have been another 6 or 8 or 10 months. And I discovered that something had actually happened in our household. The war seemed to be over. You know? They'd quit chasing me with a blue paper. And they're living like kittens. Yeah. And that was quite a discovery. Beautiful discovery. Some months later, I discovered I was still out in the office, trying to clean up my desk. That boss of mine had come in and throw me through the window. But he didn't do it. Because he recognized that something had happened. I didn't know it, but he did. And he didn't throw me through the window. And I'm still down there trying to clean up my desk. And business is good. Everything's going fine at the office. And what a beautiful discovery this is. And months go by again. And I discover that my state of being, my life, is much better than I ever dreamed it would be. Life is good. And that's a good discovery. And maybe 5 years, maybe 6 years have gone by now. And I discover that I'm never alone anymore. I have walked alone all my life. And I'm never alone anymore. I've got a God of my very own. And wherever I am, He is. Ah, what a discovery this is. This is the great discovery. When we make this discovery, the search is over. And life begins. Life begins. It's fantastic. And it comes about just as simply and beautifully as attending these meetings and doing these things and sharing our love one with another, helping each other over the hurdles of life. And it comes about. And, of course, the great, great discovery includes the knowledge that freedom is an inside job. Freedom is an inside job. My own peace of mind and serenity of purpose depends on nothing but my own relationship with my very own God. Now, a few little things that I love so much. In the very early days, a kid came up to me after meeting, and he said to me, "Chuck, you know why it's so hard for us to find God?" And I thought, oh, my God, you know. I've got to sit here and listen to 2 hours discussion, you know, about finding God. And I didn't want to. I wanted to get out of there. But he had me trapped. And I had to say, no. Why is it so hard for us to find God? And he says, because he ain't lost. Because he ain't lost. Says, you see, all we got to do is come back home. And we find he's always been there. We've been away. And then an old boy came up from Texas, incidentally. He was originally from Flint, Michigan. And his name was Big Smith. I haven't seen him for several years now. But Big Smith had done everything there is to do. Like running his car off of piers, you know, into the ocean. And through brick buildings and stuff. And he had one leg about that much longer than the other, and he walked like he was sneaking up on somebody. And he came into the group I was in that night, and he had a plaque under his arm, and he'd gotten it in a hospital right down here in Texas someplace. And he had this plaque under his arm, and he said to me, read this. And I read it. And it says, if you're not as close to God as you'd like to be, or as you once were, make no mistake, you're the one that moved. Smitty says, you see, all we got to do is come back home. And we find that God's always been there. We've been away. And the kid, again. And I saw him just the other day. I didn't know for years who had said this. This is 20-some years ago. And it was a Sunday night like this, and I'd talked at Highland Park. And three or four of us were standing in the middle of the room, and we were talking about how fortunate can a man be. How fortunate can a man be for a tongue-chewing, babbling, idiot drunk to have a life like mine, you know. How fortunate can you get? And one of these kids wasn't saying a thing. And pretty soon he looked at me and he said, Chuck, I'm ignorant. He says, I never read no books. He says, no sense in me reading books because I don't understand. He says, I don't know nothing about the Bible. I don't know nothing about God. But this no man can take away from me. When I do these simple things, one day at a time, to the best of my ability, I feel clean inside. And good things happen in my life. And when I could talk, I said, man, don't ever read no books. No time. This is what the book's written about. This is the thing itself. That we might feel clean inside and have good things happen as we go down the corridor. And so, again, when we come back home and get honest enough with ourselves to perform according to the best we know, one day at a time, something happens. And with Brother Lawrence, we can look deep within ourselves and find ourselves, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. Freedom is an inside job. Now, when we find ourselves, what are we supposed to do? Go about our Father's business. And we've got it laid out for us in the 12th step. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. A lifetime job written right down there in the 12th step. And so we go about our Father's business, trying to help his kids do things they need to have done because we want to. And he takes care of us. That's not my business. That's his business. My business is to do these things. It's his business to take care of me. And he's done an infinitely better job than I ever did. And I'm so grateful against him. And so I like to think of it every once in a while like this. And with this I quit. You know, out on the coast, we call new people babies. I think you do down here, too. Back east, you call them pigeons. But a couple of thousand years ago, there's a guy around here. He had a few babies, too. He had 12 of them. You know, followed him around, helped him. And he counseled them. And one of them was sort of a maverick. He might have been an alcoholic. Shouldn't say that down here in the Bible Belt. But he might have been an alcoholic. Because when he got caught with the goods on him, he lied out of it. You see? Or maybe you didn't do that, but that sounds suspiciously like me. And so maybe because he was a maverick, the carpenter loved him better than anybody else. And it was about time for him to go, and so he called old Pete in. Now, a lot of people call him St. Peter, and I guess I should, too. But I call him old Pete, not because I don't respect him, but because I do. I love him. Love him to death. So I call him old Pete. So he calls old Pete in, and he says, Peter, do you love me? And Peter says, yeah, Lord. And he says, tend my sheep. And he turned right around and asked him again. He says, Peter, do you love me? Yea, Lord. He says, tend my sheep. And the third time he asked him, Peter, do you love me? Yea, Lord. And the third time he says, tend my sheep. Now it begins to appear that he meant tend my sheep. Now, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. We could take that third step this morning, and for just a minute, we could change it a little. We could say, the 12th step, I mean, we could say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to tend his sheep and practice these principles in all of our affairs. And, of course, it's in tending the sheep that we come to know the shepherd. God bless you. Thank you very much.
Remain standing, if you will. We'll close the meeting in the general way. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever.